$1 home, and I'd like you to meet David. Please read for me the contents of this piece of paper.
Dearest friend, since Vincent's gone to that business trip of his, you're welcome to come over and keep me company. Since Valentine's is coming up, I have a little request. Roses are red, violets are blue, come back to bed, I really miss you. Always
The Sheila slash sugar lips that is being referred to on this note is you?
No.
No.
That is not true.
This isn't your handwriting?
No, that is forged. It's not mine.
Your signature?
No.
Are you aware of what perjury is, Mrs. Long?
No.
It's when you lie on the stand after having taken an oath to tell only the truth. So I'll ask you once again, is this your signature, Mrs. Long?
Me.
Me? I'd like to ask you strongly to consider your answer this time when I ask you this question. Did you write this note for Mr. Melroy that was found in his home?
Oh, right, fine! Yes, okay, I wrote the note. Yes, I had an affair with Fred, but that was a long time ago. I adored my husband.
Like a soap opera, huh? Like a soap opera. A lot of fun. You will be able to download your plays from either my laboratory website once we get a little bit more storage space. This is the power of high technology. If any of you have Apple computers, you can use Apple QuickTime Broadcast and you can stream live just as you take in a cam. And so it's automatic. It compresses and does everything. That's the way we do everything in the class. Thank you all for being such a great sport, and I hope you learned a lot. But as I was thinking last night, as I was running around the perimeter quite late, I was thinking, that's a pretty unique experience, going over to law school and using the moot courtroom and getting dressed up and acting out in a play and stuff, and thanks for really being good sports and really getting into your roles and hopefully learning something which was valuable. And listening to many of you yesterday, I think I kept saying, God, would it really be nice if all my colleagues could be there to see what you're doing? And that's one of the reasons why we film these things and put them up on the web, and it'll be webcasted, and everybody can look at it and watch it, but it's very unique. You're the only class that has ever done anything like this, HC70A classes. And so I congratulate you on all of that. Ramona is from Teach for America.
Yeah.
And I'm going to let her spend 5 minutes, no more, three at the most, talking to you about a very, very unique program of which I've participated in. I participated in Teach for America, going down to the inner cities, Los Angeles School, teaching science to eighth graders, and it's a remarkable organization, and the people that volunteer for Teach for America, I think it's 2 years, are an absolutely brilliant, unique group of young people. And so if you can take the microphone from Mike and take 3 minutes, and that's it.
Hi, everybody. My name is Romina. I'm a fourth-year marine biology major here at UCLA, and I'm here to talk to you guys about Teach for America. Thank you for that nice introduction. Many of you may have already heard about Teach for America. You just heard a nice little introduction. But for those of you who aren't familiar with it, let me start off by stating to you some alarming statistics. By the time they're 9 years old, children in low-income communities are already 3 grade levels behind their wealthier peers in math and reading. That means that these children in the low-income communities will barely be able to read books like Cat in the Hat or Sesame Street books, when they should, in fact, be able to read books like Harry Potter or Babysitter's Club, or I don't remember what boys read at that age, but but yeah, those books, they won't be able to read those either, which is really, really sad. I mean, this shouldn't be happening right now. At this time of age, we think, you know, that America, we have the greatest education. You guys are all sitting here receiving one of the most prestigious educations here in the U.S. And yet, if you see, like, right across, you know, just Wilshire, you'll see that there's a lot of children here who are not getting the same opportunity that they deserve. What's even more startling is the fact that students in low-income communities are 7 times less likely to attend a college or a university. So that's why I'm here today, because Teach for America believes that this should be our nation's next civil rights issue. And so in short term, we call upon outstanding recent college graduates to commit 2 years to teach in rural and urban areas all over the United States. There are 22 regions all over the place. There's in LA, in the Bay Area, up all the way over to New York, all over the place. And basically, you commit the 2 years, and then you go on, you teach. You can teach from K through 12, any subject area. In elementary school, of course, you'll teach multi subjects. So basically, what's even greater about Teach for America is the fact that some of you may have already been thinking about graduate school or medical school or law school, and you're thinking, oh, I don't think I want to do this. I already have plans. It's okay. Forget about it. But the great thing about Teach for America is the fact that we have a lot of partnerships with graduate schools, and they will defer your application or acceptance for 2 years, those 2 years that you commit, because they really, really value what you obtain during those 2 years that you commit to Teach for America. Your commitment, the leadership skills that you attain, and also the communication skills. So I'm here today because our application deadline, final application deadline for this year is tomorrow. The application is very, very simple, though. Let me just tell you, I applied, and it was very easy. It was really quick. And it just takes maybe a couple hours just to do the essays. That's the hardest part. So for those of you who are even thinking about maybe doing this, just other options, make sure you apply tomorrow. Just go to the website. It's www.teachforamerica.org. Any questions that you have, you can contact Teach for America just right away, and they will get back to you within 24 hours. Does anyone have any questions? Yeah, during the 2 years you commit, you will obtain your teaching credentials. For me, I will be teaching in LA next year, and so I will be going either to UCLA or LMU or Cal State Northridge to take classes once a week to obtain my credentials during the 2 years.
One more question.
Did you say that it's only open to people who are going to be graduating after 4 years?
You have to be graduating the year before you do it. So I'm graduating this spring, therefore I will be starting next year.
Great.
So if you're graduating this spring, you can apply.
Thanks.
But for the rest of you who are thinking about applying in the future, make sure you look into it right now. I'll pass out these brochures.
Why don't you just give them to Mike, and we'll pass them out at the end of class.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Mike, can you take these and we'll give them out at the end? I don't usually do that, but for Teach for America, I'm very... Mike, why don't you just... We'll do it after class. Thanks. Thank you very much. I don't usually do that, but for Teach for America, I'll do it. I must say that I've had some of the best students that I've ever had volunteer for Teach for America, and I will also tell you that if you do 2 years of Teach for America, you go to the top of the list in getting entry into graduate school, medical school, law school, or business school. It's considered to be a very, very prestigious thing to do. And as I said, all the students that I've interacted with that have done Teach for America, including my nephew, have been, you know, just super incredible and super dedicated. Although I must say that the 2 years that you participate in Teach for America, you do some really great stuff, but you do it under the most difficult and challenging circumstances. And so consider doing it because I think it's... I don't think that there's anything that anyone can do more than give back to a society that they get so much from. And I think that I've always been very, very much in favor of everyone graduating from high school or college having to do 1 to 2 years of voluntary service in some aspect. And I think that's something that our society could benefit tremendously from, which has been talked about through many of the years but has never been implemented. And I think it would be absolutely amazing if all of you and all of us had to do 2 years in some capacity in hospital, military, teaching, whatever. And I think it would go a long way to uniting us as a society, to getting us to understand different peoples and different cultures and different, you know, ethnic and economic opportunities. But I think it would also contribute tremendously to the spirit of America. Enough of a speech on that. Let me talk about what's coming up. If those of you who haven't emailed me about the laboratory, if you're interested in the laboratory, please do so. The slots are rapidly filling up, so please don't delay. Send me emails as fast as possible so that I can get back to you next week, because I think first pass and second pass is coming up next week in terms of registration for the winter quarter. A number of you have already, many of you actually, have already emailed, so please do that today. Don't delay if you're interested. And truthfully, if you really want to know about it, talk to Mike, talk to Gloria, and it's really, really something which is very unique and very special. Next week is going to be a very interesting, exciting time for a variety of reasons, but one of the reasons is because of the discussion next week, which will be on stem cells, human cloning, and in vitro fertilization, very timely topics. Don't forget to get the articles when you leave. The first article is Pandora's Baby. It's on in vitro fertilization, which is where all of this starts. Then a few articles on stem cells. Another one on human cloning, cloning human embryos. And then a couple of review articles that are very timely that I gave you that sort of reiterate everything and complement everything again on stem cells. One from Scientific American, a whole special issue, and another one from National Geographic. Keep in mind when you read about the Korean cloning of humans, it was a hoax. We're not going to talk too much about that in class next week, but there's a lot of things to talk about, and I will be talking about some stuff that complement that. So please read these articles. Be prepared for very, very, very cogent. You haven't had discussion in a couple of weeks. Come prepared, but this is really timely. This is very important, and it affects all of you, particularly since there's an executive directive that prevents any federal funding research on any of this stuff. And so that's something that you will discuss next week, of whether there should be a ban against doing any kind of basic research on human stem cells. You have your take-home test that you're working on. Here are the office hours. Office hours are 11 to 2 on Wednesday, which are mine, 10 to 2 on Friday, which are Mike and Gloria's. Please use them. I know that they're very productive when you come in. Many of you haven't come in to see me. I would urge you to do that, and that should help you with anything that you're not, that you may be confused about. Next week we have dinners. I'm mistaken. There's a Thursday dinner next week, not a Tuesday dinner. That's my error. Jessica reminded me of the fact that there's a dinner next Thursday, and then the Thursday after, and the Thursday after, and then the Tuesday. So if you haven't RSVP'd for next week, please do so, because it's going to be a fun dinner. We have another guest speaker, a very unique guest speaker, Dr. Michelle Evans, who will be talking a week from Thursday. Please do not miss this class, because she's a very unique individual, an incredible role model for those of you that are thinking of going on in medicine and also having a family and someone who actually does in vitro fertilization and implants human embryos for making babies and is involved in pre-implantation genetic testing and is really an expert at all of this stuff. And she's going to be talking a week from today on fertility, which is going to surprise many of you, problems with fertility in both males and females. She'll be talking about in vitro fertilization. She'll be talking about genetic testing and giving you some case studies. And there's going to be some fun things that are going to happen before her lecture, but I'm not going to tell you what it is. And then we're going to have reception afterwards, and then we're going to go to dinner for those of you that are scheduled. So please RSVP. Reading for lecture today, I gave you an article. Nick, please read that article and also the articles for discussion. And word to the wise here. And it's on the molecular genetics of hemophilia. And also we have chapter 11 in your text, which you should be fairly familiar with at this stage of the game. And today I'm going to give you a case study of how you go from a gene to a drug, and I'm going to be reviewing a lot of stuff, but I am going to say that there's going to be a couple of technically challenging parts to this lecture, and I'm going to want you to pay attention to these technically challenging parts. Can you turn the microphone up just a little bit? Technically challenging parts, because in order to understand the human genome, you have to understand a couple of the things that I'm going to be talking about, and it's probably maybe the most technically challenging stuff that you'll have the entire quarter, but I'll try and make it as conceptual as I can. It's not too bad, is it, Mike? You could do it, so just keep in mind. So I'm going to be reviewing a lot of stuff for you, but I'm going to be covering a lot of really interesting things. And then I also want to say that this lecture, for better or for worse, will be the last in a while on science, and on Tuesday I'm going to start at least one to two and maybe three lectures on the relationship between science and the Constitution, and I'm going to be talking about how, what laws there are that regulate science, but more than that I'm going to be talking about intellectual property and patenting genes and all of these things, and all of you have a handout that's approximately 103 pages long, and you'll have on Tuesday probably, what is there, 15 handouts at least that'll deal with laws, copyrights, trademarks, all the federal patent laws, the Constitution of the United States, all kinds of things that are important for the things that I'll be talking about. So that's coming up starting next week. Regardless of how far I get today, I'm going to start the law because I love talking about it. It's a hobby of mine. Any questions about anything that's on your mind? Lisa, do you have any questions about anything? You're happy? Yeah. You're very happy? There we go. Daisy, you're happy?
Oh, yeah.
Where'd you get that little outfit you were wearing yesterday?
Some girl in the sorority.
Some girl in the sorority gave it to you?
Yeah.
Wow. Thought you went down to Melrose to get that thing specifically for your play.
Nope.
No, you didn't find some special boutique down in Melrose, huh?
I don't think I would pay money for that.
You wouldn't, huh? Okay. Let me set the scene here. And whether you know it or not, we've covered a lot of ground. And Mike, wave your hand at me about 5 o'clock, will you? We've covered a lot of ground this quarter. But you haven't really quite realized it yet, because it's been, in my crazy way, done in various different components of this class. But when you think about the applications of genetic engineering and you look at this little handout, which presumably you have, you look and see all the things that you've covered to a certain extent. You've talked about making drugs in bacteria using genetic engineering. You've talked about making drugs in animals and in plants, vaccines. Those are applications of genetic engineering. You've talked about using genetic engineering to clone genes and to study their structure and to study their function. Just basic stuff. That's how we learn that there's introns in genes, and that's how we learn that genes have modular structures, and that's how we learned about alternative splicing, and that's how we learned about everything that I've talked about, really, and that is from cloning genes and from studying them and from trying to understand them and from sequencing them. So you've learned about that, and you've learned a little bit about sequencing and genomics, although I'm going to talk more about that next, well, not next week, but the week after for sure. So you learned about that. You learned about genetic engineering of animals, and you learned about genetic engineering of plants. You learned about genetic engineering of plants for insect resistance and other things. We didn't go into it in huge depth, but you learned about it and talked a little bit about the pros and the cons of all those things. You learned about the applications of genetic engineering in forensics in terms of using, obviously, probes to VNTR probes and other things to pinpoint people who might perpetrate crimes and to exonerate those that haven't. And you've learned about using genetic engineering to find probes, and we'll talk more about this, to diagnose diseases and to diagnose pathogens and to follow whether or not people are carriers of disease genes or whatever. So you've learned a tremendous amount in terms of what genetic engineering is all about. And so I don't have to go into in great depth a lot of those things, but what I think is important is in one place to conceptualize it all for you and to bring it all together so that you can understand how important all of these things are and to sort of give you a better foundation in genetic engineering from the point of view of many of you who have been just sort of learning things and sometimes struggling and sometimes not. And so what I'm going to do today, and hopefully I'll be able to finish because I'm going to summarize a lot of things, especially in those parts that you're familiar with, is I'm going to say, how do you go from a gene to a drug? In other words, I'm going to give you a particular case study, and I'm going to tell you exactly how you can go from a pedigree where there's a devastating disease in the family and then use genetic engineering and the tools of genetic engineering to eventually have a drug that can be used to treat these people. And the disease that I'm going to use is a disease called hemophilia. That's a blood disorder, which we've talked about. And I'm going to tell you this story because it's a beautiful example of a success story using genetic engineering. It's a beautiful example in being able to make a drug using genetic engineering that keeps people alive as long as they live naturally, whereas without this drug, they died at age 20 or before from bleeding to death. As sort of crazy as that sounds, in this day and age, people died because they weren't able to form clots in their blood. And I'm going to show you how the miracles of genetic engineering and the technology which has been established from a technical point of view allowed that to be a thing of the past. And I'm going to go through a lot of iterations in between. And so I want you to follow along with what I'm going to tell you because in many respects it illustrates the power of the technology. But what's so remarkable about this technology that I'm telling you about is because of the sequence of the human genome, it's now basically all obsolete because no one would do any of this anymore. And so really what you're learning about is the foundation that allowed all of your genes to be sequenced, and now people would just go in a test tube someplace and look for these genes and wouldn't use this technology to a certain extent. They'd use other kinds of technology to do it, although, as I'll point out, the foundation of everything lies in cloning and genetic engineering, and I don't want you to forget that. So we have a case, and most of what I'm going to tell you, well, not most of it, but the conceptual points of what I'm going to tell you is in that Scientific American article, and you should read it, and frankly, it will help you with your take-home test immeasurably, as will this lecture that I'm going to give. And there's going to be a lot of things in this lecture that are in your handout that I'm not going to cover because you're going to have to put them down in your take-home test a little bit and learn about them on your own. But you'll see conceptually what they are when I go over them. So we have hemophilia. And hemophilia is due to a defect in genes that are involved in clotting of your blood. And there's many genes that are involved. And you, in fact, studied one of those genes called protein C. you studied that particular protein when you read about transgenic animals and genetic engineering of sheep to make drugs or cows to make drugs, and talked about post-translational modifications and how it was more effective to do this in an animal than in a bacterium. So that was a subject of one of your discussions a few weeks ago. Hemophilia is really one of the oldest diseases known to humankind, and that is that it's really one of the few genetic diseases that's actually mentioned in the Bible. It's one of the few genetic diseases in which there was a excuse, so to speak, way back when in biblical times for circumcision. In other words, if you were in a Hebrew population, you know, thousands of years ago, and if it was shown that newborn males would bleed to death because they were circumcised, if they had hemophilia, which they did, they just died. There was no way to stop the bleeding. If that showed up in a family, it was recognized very early on that there was something wrong with this family, and therefore that family, the males, were then excused from having circumcision, and the newborn males were not circumcised because that was the only way to be able to keep them alive. So this is known as a bleeding disorder. It's one which is classic, which we talked about, that went in royal families in Europe in the 17th and 18th century. So it's something which really caused a lot of deaths, most of them very, very, very silent deaths, so to speak, and must have been horrible deaths. But I can imagine that if one had this in their family, it would have been something that would have been pretty scary, because you wouldn't know whether you had it or not in the pre-genetics or in the modern era, so to speak. So it's due to this lack of a protein, any one of these proteins, which are involved in clotting. And these are proteins which make these clots. You know what a clot is. We don't have to talk about it. But the fact of the matter is that it's a cascade. And it's a cascade of protein activation. And what I mean by protein activation is that these proteins are present in your blood, but they're not doing anything until they're activated by a wound. And so a clot is basically a wound response. You get a wound, you bleed, it initiates wounding, and if it wasn't a wound-induced response, you'd be in pretty bad shape, wouldn't you, Chris? Because if your blood clotted, you'd be dead, because you wouldn't be able to survive. And in fact, there is a genetic disorder, which is a lethal genetic disorder, in a gene which specifies antithrombin. And antithrombin is another protein in your blood that prevents clotting. And if you have a mutation in antithrombin, basically the fetus has a massive blood clot and dies. And antithrombin happens to be a very important drug, by the way. We talked a little bit about it, but not very much. So the point here is there's an elaborate control mechanism to prevent clotting in your blood, or to have clotting occur when you have a wound, and that's due to many different genes, and here they're all listed here, all proteins, but these proteins have to be activated by modifications after translation. So this is an example where the gene is active, the messenger RNA is around, the messenger RNA is translated, but those proteins just sit around and don't do anything until a wound comes and something happens to those proteins, and they get activated, and they carry out this response. And in fact, it's called a cascade, because one activation leads to another specific activation, leads to another specific activation, leads to another specific activation. In other words, one response causes a protein to be modified, which then causes that protein to modify another protein, which causes that protein to modify another protein, et cetera, until you get this stuff called fibrin, which makes the clot and heals the wound, and which is a subject of tremendous amount of research, wound response. The biggest question is, how can you get rid of scars? It's a subject that plastic surgeons and people that are in the area of dermatology are working on like crazy, because you can imagine that if you could prevent scars from happening, that that would be something which everyone would want. But it's all involved in this wound response. Also keep in mind that there are drugs. One of them is called TPA. It's a genetically engineered drug, tissue plasminogen activator. I'm not going to go into precisely what this does, but this is a drug which dissolves clots. So not only do you have clotting proteins that are activated in your blood, but you have these anti-clotting proteins. And if you didn't have these anti-clotting proteins, you'd also be in bad shape, because sometimes clots happen and you have to get rid of them. And if you don't, you'd have a massive heart attack or a stroke. These are not fun things to have. And so people that are prone to heart disease and have had heart attacks, sometimes they're given TPA. It's a miracle drug, and it prevents clots. And if it prevents clots, it can prevent strokes, it can prevent a bunch of things, but it's one of the most commonly used biotech, genetically engineered drugs that there are. Okay, we have a couple of genes that are involved in this disease called hemophilia. We have a disease called hemophilia A and hemophilia B. Two different genes specifying two different clotting factors. Both of those genes on the X chromosome, but a different loci of the X chromosome, but they're involved in, as you can see, hemophilia A is factor 8, hemophilia B is factor 9. Two different genes, two different loci, two different proteins, two different messenger RNAs, but involved in the clotting cascade. And I'm going to really reflect mostly on hemophilia A today. Now, you can notice that they're found in a very high frequency in male populations. High frequency in male populations. Why do you think that is? High frequency. Easter? High frequency in male populations.
It's sex-linked.
Yeah, so both of those genes are on the X chromosome, and as you'll see in a second, those are transmitted directly from mothers to sons. But why in a high frequency? It's okay, there's lots of genes on the X chromosome. Muscular dystrophy gene is on the X chromosome. Color blindness gene is on the X chromosome. There's thousands of genes on the X chromosome. Why are these found in high frequency? Well, take a stab at it.
I'm not sure. I know.
Well,
that.
Think about a hypothesis. If there are lots of mutations in a gene, what would that say about the gene? If there are lots of mutations in a gene, what would that say about the gene? Would the gene be large or small?
Large.
So you think there's a greater chance of having a mutation in a large gene than a small gene?
Small.
No? Do you think there's a greater chance of having mutations in a large gene or a small gene?
I guess large.
You guess? What causes mutations? We talked about it on Tuesday.
Random. It just happens randomly.
But what is the mechanism? We talked about it on Tuesday. I spent a lot of time on that, didn't I, Mike? What are some of the causes of mutations, Easter?
I don't remember.
How about Hannah helping you out? Just a few.
Happen during replication.
Pardon?
During replication.
What happens?
Just
generally.
Just like a purine matches with.
So there's a mispairing. What else can happen?
A certain amount can be either deleted or
added. So we could have mispairing, or we could have deletions or insertions. Hannah, do you think that if the gene was larger, there'd be a greater chance for a mutation than if it was smaller?
Yes, because they're more.
Absolutely. So what do you think the size of these hemophilia genes
are? They must be much larger.
They're huge. And so therefore, there's a great chance that you could get mutations in those genes because they're big. It's target size. The bigger the gene, the greater the chance of mutation, the more nucleotides. And it's directly proportional to the size of the gene, unless you have hot spots. So if you have hot spots, then everything changes. But clearly, one of the reasons why there's a high frequency of these in male populations is because of the fact that they're passed on from females to males. And they're large genes. But what's another hypothesis we talked about on Tuesday? Present in high frequency in certain populations. Becca?
Why would it be present in one population?
Yeah.
Well, if you just have that one population that tends to breed with each other, then it would kind of stay in that
population. So like a founder effect.
Yeah.
And would stay in that population. So it's kind of like an inbreeding situation where this thing just popped up. You're not going to be able to get rid of it. And the reason why you're not going to be able to get rid of it is because it's in highest frequency in carriers if it's recessive. So you're not going to be able to identify those except in specific families. And so it's just going to stay there, basically. It's going to stay there. And that's why you'd find them in certain populations, this particular mutation in certain cases. So we have hemophilia A and hemophilia B. I'm not going to go through the pedigree, But remember, we talked about the fact that you can find out the mode of inheritance by looking at the pedigree. This happens to be the pedigree of hemophilia in the royal family. Went through the royal families of Europe, in England, in Russia, Prussia, variety of different kings and queens and princes and whatever, and czars. But the point is that it was a sex-linked disease passed on because of its presence on the X chromosome. And I'm not going to go into the inheritance of this in detail because you can work it out for yourself, but there basically it is worked out. What we have here is fathers and mothers. The father has an X chromosome and a Y chromosome. The mother has two X chromosomes. Note that that mother is a carrier because these are recessive genes on the X chromosome. And so therefore, you have to have two copies of this allele to manifest the disease. And because it's a sex-linked trait, the fathers get always X chromosomes from their mothers. So every male in this room has received an X chromosome from their mother. And therefore, if you have a carrier which has two X chromosomes, one of those X chromosomes is going to have the hemophilia gene. And since males have one X and a Y, the presence of just one allele can manifest that disease. It's called hemizygous as opposed to heterozygous. There's nothing that can max it or cover it up. And so you have one X chromosome which is affected, one X chromosome which is a wild-type allele. These are passed to the sons in the next generation, and therefore a characteristic of a sex-linked gene that's recessive is that carrier mothers pass this gene on to half of their sons all the time. And so 50% of their sons would be afflicted by this disease, and because there's no counteracting wild-type allele, they will always have this disease. Always. It's different if it's dominant, obviously, but in this recessive situation. And that's a diagnostic test for whether or not there's a sex-linked disease, the inheritance pattern that we talked about. And furthermore, once it became known that it was sex-linked, and once studies, and you can recognize this from one of your Scientific American article readings, once it was recognized that you could place human genes on human chromosomes, they knew it was sex-linked, they knew it was on the X chromosome, they could place this gene on the X chromosome. I'm not going to go into precisely right now how they could do that. I'll talk a little bit about that more in a week or two. But the point is that this particular gene is right down here. And what's novel about this gene is it's right next to the gene for color blindness. And color blindness was a good marker for hemophilia. They're almost 100% linked. And so those individuals that were shown to be colorblind were thought to be at risk for hemophilia. And those families that were colorblind and had color blindness in them mostly had a high frequency of hemophilia in them. And so this is an example where you could have a phenotypic marker in human populations, not a molecular marker, that's linked to hemophilia gene and can warn people, hey, you might be able to have this particular disease. This is the X chromosome. It's a very big chromosome. Here's the Leishmanian disease that we talked about for self-mutilation. Here's factor 9, which is coding for hemophilia B. Here's factor 8, which is hemophilia A. And again, it's linked to that particular color blindness. And I'm not going to go into those bands and how they were formed. I talked a little bit about that in discussion, and I'll talk about that when I talk about the human genome. So the issue is we have a pedigree. And we have a pedigree that shows that we have color blindness. We have hemophilia in a family. And with the advent of molecular biology and genetic engineering, one would like to find that gene, knowing nothing about it except this pedigree and the fact that it's a blood protein, but you don't know anything else. So here's the dilemma. We're going back 20 years now. The dilemma is that you have a lethal gene. I know it sounds very ironic now, but the hemophilia gene was lethal. Because if you bled, you bled to death. There was no way of stopping it. So in fact, these hemophilia genes were lethal genes in populations of humans that had no drugs to treat this particular disease. So before the advent of genetic engineering, this was a lethal disease, as I said. And so the question is, we have this pedigree. And we want to know, what is the gene? All we know is that it's sex-linked. We know that it's on the X chromosome. And we know that the clotting factor, that is the hemophilia 8, the factor 8, is in the blood. That's what we know. We know that it's a protein in the blood, because one of the ways they tried to treat hemophilia was to give transfusions of individuals that didn't have hemophilia that had the clotting factor. That was one of the ways to try and save these individuals by infusing good blood from someone that matched, obviously had the same blood type, and they would cause the blood to clot. So the point is we have a blood protein, we have X chromosome, sex link, we don't know anything else. Nothing. We don't know what the gene is. We don't know anything about the structure of the gene because we haven't isolated it by cloning. We don't know where the gene is active, Chris. Just because the blood protein is there doesn't mean that the protein was made in the blood. It could be made someplace else and shipped to the blood. It's a very important point. Just because the protein's in the blood doesn't mean it's in the blood. It's like insulin's made in the pancreas, but it functions in the blood. So it's transported like a hormone. So the fact of the matter is we know nothing about it, but we want to find this gene. We want to find this gene because we want to use that to make a drug. But more than that, we'd like to find the messenger RNA because really we'd like to make a cDNA to make the drug because you know there's problems with using genes to make drugs from your discussion. But we don't know anything about it. This is a big dilemma, isn't it, David? It's huge. It's a big problem. If you're trying to find out what that gene is in order to make a drug, to turn a lethal disease into a non-lethal disease by being able to have a drug to treat it. And so what was known before these experiments were started? What was known? Well, again, it was known that it was a blood protein. It was known that it could be purified from thousands of liters of blood, mostly cow blood, and studied, because all mammals have these clotting factors. It's not just human beings. It was known that they could purify a little bit of the protein from animals, a little bit of the protein from humans. I'm not going to get into exactly how they did that. And it was known that, again, it was a blood protein. So the only thing that they knew something about was the protein. Didn't know anything else. And so the deal here is in this pre-genomics era, in this early genetic engineering era, in this era before all the genes in the human genome were sequenced, one has to use the protein to find the gene in some way, using the principles of molecular biology, using the rules of the genetic code, all kinds of other things. But the only thing they knew about was the protein, and therefore the protein had to be the starting point. Couldn't go from anywhere else because you didn't have anything else. And furthermore, you couldn't get enough of this protein to make an antibody. So you couldn't use any antibody tests or anything like that that you read about in discussion and talked about in discussion. So you can isolate genes in two ways, as you know. And what I mean by isolate a gene, I mean identify a gene. Everything starts with recombinant DNA. Everything starts with cloning. Everything starts with either cloning the messenger RNA or the gene, as you will see in a few minutes. But you can go from the protein to the gene if you know the sequence of amino acids in the protein because, James, you know the genetic code. And if you know the genetic code, you can predict the nucleotide sequence. So if you know the protein sequence, you can predict, although there's problems with this, as you'll see, because of degeneracy in the genetic code, you can predict, at least theoretically, what the DNA sequence would be in the messenger RNA or in the coding portion of the gene. Alternatively, you can identify a gene if you could purify the messenger RNA, because then you'd have a probe to find the gene in a genome library. Or if you could purify the messenger RNA, you could make a complementary clone, a cDNA clone, and sequence that and then use that as a probe to find the gene from a genome library. Or in this genomics era, all you do is just sequence the stuff. That's all you do. And then look in one of these databases and say, ah, this cDNA clone codes for hemoglobin or clones for TPA or whatever. I'm going to say that again. In the 21st century, which is now, people just sequence everything. And because the databases are so big, because so many genomes and messenger RNAs have been sequenced, just about anything you could ever imagine that exists probably is going to be in one of these databases, certainly if it's a mammalian gene. And therefore, you'll be able to find it just by doing what you did a few weeks ago in discussion, going on to the NIH server and doing these blasts. Say, oh, yeah, my clone is a membrane protein or something like that. But before that, it was much more difficult. And so one can find the gene by going from the protein to the gene conceptually, or you can find the gene if you could have, in those days, purified the messenger RNA, like the insulin messenger RNA, and started from that. But in the case of factor VIII, they didn't have any messenger RNA. Why? They didn't know where the gene was active. They didn't have any messenger RNA. Why? Because they didn't know where to look. And they only had a tiny bit of protein, a smidgen. I mean, just precious, precious amounts, not even enough to use for anything. And so all they could really do is find out a little bit about the amino acid sequence of that protein. And so keep that in mind. So I'm not going to go into this as purely a review. I don't have to say anything, but I need to say it just to remind you that the whole purpose of cloning or the purpose of the polymerase chain reaction is to get enough of a gene in order to study it. We talked about that. Remember the other Nick, Nico. We talked about that a few weeks ago when we talked about why you need to do cloning, why you need to amplify it. You have to get your hands on something to study it. And these things are present in tiny, tiny amounts inside cells. And so the first thing we talked about almost 6-7 weeks ago was the fact that the purpose of cloning is to amplify something in order to get your hands on it. And that's also the purpose of the polymerase chain reaction. So we want to clone something in order to purify it away from a population of something. If there's 35,000 genes in the human genome, we want to get one gene and forget about the other 29,999. We can only do that by cloning or by the polymerase chain reaction. But you cannot use the polymerase chain reaction unless you clone the gene first, because you need to have its sequence. So everything starts with cloning, everything with what I'm talking about now. After that, you can use other kinds of things. And therefore, in order to do this, you need certain tools, and I'm not going to go over this, because you know most of these tools, although I'm going to throw some curves at you in a couple of minutes. I'm going to throw some big curves at you in a couple of minutes. But as far as you know, you need certain things. Well, you need cells. And that should be obvious, because you use the cell's transcription, translation, DNA replication machinery. Remember, everything's natural in order to clone a gene in those cells. And you can use mammalian cells, as you'll see in the case of making a factor VIII drug. The drug was not made in bacteria. It was made in mammalian cells. You can use mammalian cells. You can use bacterial cells. You can use yeast. You can use any kind of cells as you want. But you have to have cells, because in order to clone it, you have to have the replication machinery. And if you want to express the gene, you have to have the transcription, translation, post-translational modification machinery in order to do it. So you need cells. And then, of course, you need a whole bunch of little enzymes which catalyze reactions. And these are enzymes that are involved in nucleic acid metabolism. I'm going to say that again. All the enzymes that are used for recombinant DNA are found in natural cells, mostly bacteria, but some in human cells and other cells. And these things are involved in the metabolism of nucleic acids. And so those enzymes that are being used for recombinant DNA or used for the polymerase chain reaction are enzymes that are used by creatures, some creatures, for their ordinary functioning. And so don't lose sight of that. They were discovered at some particular point in time and studied. I remember when people were studying restriction enzymes, no one could understand why they were studying them. In fact, in the old days, you couldn't even get a grant to study restriction enzymes because they were considered to be so esoteric and so limited in terms of how they applied to anything that it was a tough go until they figured out that you could use these things for recombinant DNA. And then, of course, the funding gates flooded and opened up. So you need cells, you need vectors, you need enzymes. The vectors can be a variety of things. I'm going to throw a curveball with you about a vector. They could be plasmids, they could be viruses, they can be artificial chromosomes, as you will see. Chromosomes that have been synthesized. because all the vectors have been genetically engineered. There's no natural genetic engineering vector. Whether it's a plasmid or a virus or an artificial chromosome, they're all engineered and synthetic because of this modular nature. So we have, again, cells that you have to have. We have enzymes that you need, nucleic acid enzymes. We have vectors that are responsible for replicating what you want to clone, because they have, as you'll see, origins of replication. Again, they can be viruses, chromosomes, all kinds of other things. And we have to have, you know, things to be able to find the genes or the messenger RNAs. But all this stuff is sort of review to a certain extent. So I'm not going to talk very much about restriction enzymes, but clearly you know a little bit about them, but I'll conceptualize them for you in about 2 seconds. These are enzymes that are DNA-binding proteins. I'm going to say that again. These are very specific proteins that bind to double-stranded DNA. A restriction enzyme does not bind to a single-stranded piece of DNA. It binds to double-stranded Watson-Crick double helix. And furthermore, the restriction enzymes that we're talking about bind to only specific sequences, as you know. They can bind to specific 4 nucleotide sequences, 5 nucleotide sequences, 6 nucleotide sequences, 7 nucleotide sequences, 8 nucleotide sequences, all kinds of different restriction enzymes. But they are sequence specific. And because they're sequence specific, they can be used to digest DNA in specific places and be used for recombinant DNA and for diagnostics. Because restriction enzyme sites that these enzymes bind to are dependent upon the sequence of the gene, obviously. Each gene has a unique sequence, but also, therefore, has unique sites of binding of a particular restriction enzyme. That's a very important principle that I'm going to come back to in a second. In other words, we have specific enzymes. These enzymes bind to double-stranded DNA, but they bind only to specific sequences. If they didn't bind to specific sequences, you couldn't use them for cloning at all. So these are the things that allow you to digest genes in specific ways, but they're also the things that allow you to use these enzymes as markers. You know, restriction fragment length polymorphisms, all those things derive in part from restriction sites. And so I'm not going to go into all of these things because you're familiar with them, but without restriction enzymes, you couldn't do this. And furthermore, these restriction enzymes bind to specific sites. Again, they're DNA-binding proteins. They do not bind RNA. They do not bind proteins. They do not bind carbohydrates. They bind double-stranded DNA at specific nucleotide sequences, and only specific nucleotide sequence. And each restriction enzyme has its own specificity. The bottom line is that the number of restriction enzyme sites for a genome, this is where we get a little technical, the number of restriction enzyme sites for a genome, Brian, is proportional to the size of the genome. Why is that? Can't hear you. Why is that? So if I had a genome that was 5,000 bases in length and a genome that was 5 billion, what would be the number of different sites in the larger one relative to the smaller one?
It would be just as proportional as that, meaning that if the bigger one would have that.
So if you have 5 billion in the human genome and you have 5,000 in a plasmid, how many additional restriction sites are there in the human genome?
A lot.
A million.
Something like that. Yeah,
so the point is that the number of restriction sites is proportional to the size of the genome. So that means when you digest the human genome with a restriction enzyme, what do you see? Do you see specific bands?
Yes.
You do?
Or no, sorry.
You see a smear. You can't see any specific bands because there's too many. That's why you use a DNA blot in order to see specific bands.
Yes.
Because there's, in fact, going to be a million of them. And you're going to have to do this calculation on your own for your take-home test. But the point here is that we have these restriction enzyme sites, and these restriction enzyme sites are proportional to the size of the genome simply because they're a specific sequence. And that specific sequence is found many, 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 many times just on the basis of chance and chance alone in a genome. So small genome, few restriction sites. Large genome, many restriction enzyme sites. In the human genome, there's a million of them depending upon the enzyme. And therefore, when you take the DNA from the human genome and you digest it with the restriction enzyme, you find this smear of, let's say, a million different size DNA fragments, and you need to do a DNA blot using a probe to find those two or three or four or five that you're interested in, because they're buried among these other millions. But the point here is that we have these restriction enzymes that recognize very specific base sequences, and the restriction enzyme sites are proportional to the genome. Now, I'm not going to go over this calculation here. You'll have to make this calculation for your take-home test, but the point is that you can calculate on average the number of restriction sites for a given restriction enzyme in a genome, and it's very important. But what Brian was saying and what I was saying here is that if you look on this overhead, the number of restriction enzyme sites is proportional to the genome. So if I have a genome that's small, like let's say 3,000 base pairs, you'd predict maybe only one restriction enzyme site for restriction enzyme that recognizes six base pairs. Brian, if I recognize six base pairs, eight base pairs, or four base pairs, how many sites will there be in a genome? Are there going to be more four base pair sites than six base pair sites, and more six base pair sites than eight base pair sites?
Yes.
Why would that be?
Because the sequence is not, how am I supposed to say it? The four base, you're going to find more of the like specific four base sequence than you are going to find like a six base pair sequence. Of
Why
a
is that? Just conceptually.
It's just harder to not have it be that
well,
way.
Well, what's the probability of having a specific four base pair sequence in a row?
1 in 64.
So it'd be 1/4.
To the fourth power.
And this would be 1/4.
To the sixth power.
And this would be 1/4.
To the eighth.
So therefore, the probability of this sequence is less than the probability of that sequence,
yes.
Correct?
Yes.
Therefore, in a genome, you'll have more of those sequences on the basis of chance and chance alone than you'd have these. In other words, these sequences are going to occur in a genome on the basis of random chance. And therefore, the sequences that recognize, the restriction enzymes that recognize only a few base pairs are going to be present in a larger amount than the restriction enzymes that recognize a large base pair. So if you're going to clone a genome that was very large, like the human genome, you start with restriction enzymes, right? Would you choose something that recognized eight or four? What enzyme would you choose? Would you want to work with a large number of clones or a small number of clones?
Small number of clones.
Yeah, exactly. So when you're cloning a genome or sequencing a genome, you want to work with the smallest number of clones possible. Therefore, you'd probably choose an enzyme just conceptually that recognizes as many base pairs as you want. So the point here is, and I told you I was going to get a little technical, but I'm being conceptual. The point is that these restriction enzymes are very powerful. And the only way you can clone a genome is they have restriction enzymes because they digest the genome in very specific places. And furthermore, the number of these restriction enzyme sites that occur randomly in a genome, it's just random, is going to be proportional to the size of the genome. And therefore, four base pairs is going to be present in a greater number than six or eight, just on the basis of chance and chance alone. And so if you're trying to make a genome library from the human genome or a corn genome or something which is large, you'd probably want to have an enzyme to start with that recognizes eight base pairs or even more. And I'm going to talk in a couple minutes of why that would be. But the point here is, without belaboring any more than I have, is that if you have a small genome, you can see specific bands because there's not that many of them. Does that make sense, Charles? You sure? You're positive. Tell me if you're confused. So if you have a tiny genome of only 3,000 base pairs, let's say a little virus, and if you're using an enzyme that recognizes, let's say, six base pairs, the chance of that sequence is going to be very rare. It's like one of your plasmids. Therefore, you'd probably see one band on a gel. But if you have a somewhat larger genome, let's say something which is 300,000 base pairs, about the size of the Agrobacterium TI plasmid, a little bit larger, you can still see, or mitochondrial DNA in humans, you can still see a number of bands. You can see them because the genome is small. And the number of bands that you can see with the restriction enzyme are defined. But if you have a huge genome, Daisy, like the human genome, you're going to see a smear. And furthermore, if you have small genomes, the size of those bands are going to be diagnostic for the genome. Do you agree with that, Yuditha?
I'm not sure I understand that.
Well, let's say I have virus A and virus B, and you digest them with the DNA with the same restriction enzyme. Would you expect to find the same size DNA band?
No.
Why?
Because they're two different.
Because their sequences are different.
Right.
So if you have small genomes, the restriction pattern is diagnostic for that genome. These are markers then, just like you talked about with diagnosing human disease genes. So the point here is that you can use these restriction sites for small genomes as diagnostic markers, you know, find out, is this STD you have due to a chlamydia or due to something else? You can use these kinds of diagnostic markers because these genomes are relatively small in these STDs, chlamydia, herpes, other kinds of things. The point is, I think I belabored it. So we have these restriction enzymes, and I'm not going to go into anything more except that they are the tool that we use for everything. And that's why I'm talking about it. Yes, I understand that you know what RFLPs are, but do you really understand what RFLPs are? What RFLPs are because of the restriction enzyme sites. And every gene will have a unique order of restriction enzyme sites because every gene has a unique sequence. And this is why you can use these sites to mark genes and to mark specific alleles because of these restriction enzyme sites that are present in all genes because they're just made up of nucleotide sequences. And so you use restriction enzyme sites for cloning to begin with, for mapping clones, mapping regions of genes, mapping where the intron is, where the exon is, where the start is, where the switches are. You're using these sites as a roadmap, and the only way you can engineer genes, as you know from quiz number 3, is to use specific restriction enzyme sites. Because this is the only way you can take the part of one gene and combine it specifically with the part of another gene, is you have to have these restriction enzyme sites. Diagnosis, the only way you can diagnose sickle cell allele from normal alleles with restriction enzyme site, because that site was wiped out in the sickle cell mutation. The only way you can diagnose cystic fibrosis allele from wild type normal allele is because of a restriction enzyme site, because that site was wiped out by a 3-base pair deletion in that founder mutation. And so these restriction enzymes are much more than what you put on your quizzes or what you've talked about. They're the basis of all of genetic engineering, all of gene diagnosis, all of manipulating the switch of the I gene and switching it with the NE gene in the fly. It's all of that. Is because of these restriction enzymes. The way in which we change the behavior of the female fruit fly to mate with other females is we change that little splicing junction. We did that because of restriction enzymes. That's our roadmap. There's no other way to do this. And that's why I'm talking about it here. The restriction enzyme allows you to make a map of specific genes. And the reason why we can clone and sequence the human genome, Jordan, is because of restriction enzyme sites. Without specific sites, we wouldn't know what chromosome we were working with. We wouldn't know what chromosome we were on. We wouldn't know where in the chromosome we were sequencing. These sites are the ultimate markers for everything in recombinant DNA, human genetics, breeding, anything. Keep that in mind. It's the only way you know where you are in a genome is from these sites, which are specific for genes, specific for chromosomes. So, Heather, chromosome X of humans, does it have a specific order of restriction enzyme sites?
Yes.
Absolutely. Is that order different than Y?
Yes.
Why?
Because the sequences
exactly.
are different.
is the restriction enzyme sites of the chromosome number 22 different than chromosome 21?
Yes.
So they're markers for these chromosomes. So if you were working in a pot of DNA, theoretically, you would know what chromosome you were working with by the order of these sites. Not any one site, but the order of these sites. So they're crucial. Does the hemophilia A gene have a different order of restriction enzyme sites than the hemophilia B gene? And would those bands be diagnostic?
Yes.
So if I had a probe for the hemophilia A gene, I would know that it was hemophilia A from very specific bands I could see using a southern blot. All because of the restriction enzyme sites, which are directly a function of the sequence of the gene, a sequence of the genome. And in fact, the first place that you start to sequence a whole genome, at least in the old days, was to make a restriction map of the whole genome, every chromosome. So the point here is that this is crucial, and therefore we can make these maps. How would you know that you have a circular genome as compared to a linear genome? What would you say, Matt? How do you know if you have a circular genome compared to a linear genome? How would you be able to show that unambiguously? Just conceptually. What would you predict from the map of a linear chromosome?
If it's circular, would you have fewer pieces after cutting it with the restriction enzymes?
What would you predict the shape of the map to be?
What do you mean by the shape of the map?
A map is a map.
Right.
It's like the map of a country. It has a shape. What would you predict the map of a circular genome to be?
And circular.
Yeah. What would you predict the map of a linear genome to be?
Straight.
Exactly. So the only way you could prove unambiguously that a chromosome is a circle or a chromosome is a linear piece of DNA is from the restriction enzyme map or the DNA sequence. So these maps are powerful and important in telling us what the chromosomes are, what the genes are, what the shape of the chromosome is. All of these different things derive from these restriction enzyme maps. And here's one right here. Here's the map of ECHO-R1 on this particular viral genome. And notice that the map for the sites of this enzyme is going to be different from the map of the sites of that enzyme and different from the map of that enzyme. Every enzyme has specific sites, Matt.
How do you get a circular map?
How do you get a circular map? How do you get a circular map? You'll find out all about that on your take-home test, because you're going to have a long exercise in mapping chromosomes, okay? So you'll see how to map these things. It's a lot of fun. It's like we're putting a jigsaw puzzle together, and it's a very nice intellectual challenge. And you have a map of a linear gene, and there it is. So there's the map of a gene. This was in the article you read in the second week for discussion. I know that you probably remember this figure because I know that Gloria and Mike talked about it. But the point is, this is the Wally Gilbert article of recombinant proteins in bacteria. Here we have a gene, and notice we have a map. And notice that by using this map, we could isolate a switch, we could isolate a terminating region, we could isolate an exon, we could isolate an intron, we could isolate those sequences that are responsible for clipping out those introns. Again, using these maps and restriction enzymes is the only way you can isolate these modules. Sommer, do you understand that? So if I want a switch, I need to have a map of the gene that I need the switch from in order to get that switch. If I want an exon from a gene, I need the map of that gene in order to get that specific enzyme, exon, because I use specific restriction enzymes. You did that on one of your quizzes. You kind of didn't know that you did it, but you did it because I gave you specific circumstances. But the point here is that you can't move around genes or modules without cutting them out of a gene using a restriction enzyme. And you don't know where you're cutting them out without a map. In other words, you can't get off of the 405 at Wilshire unless you know where Wilshire gets off of the 405. The point is it's exactly the same thing. So we have these maps, and for genetic engineering, it's absolutely crucial, Matt.
See, another quick question is back to the circular versus linear.
Yeah.
Let's see. Say both of them have the exact same sequence, so same number of restriction sites.
Can't have the same sequence. Every chromosome has a different sequence.
Well, just hypothetically, you have
Can't. It's no hypothetical.
Okay.
Every chromosome has a different sequence. There's no such thing as two different chromosomes having exactly the same sequence. Unless it's two chromosomes in your cells where you have a duplicate of each one. So you have two 22s and two 21s and two 16s and two 17s, but two different organisms or two different chromosomes, always different sequence. Different sequence, different map. So it can't be hypothetical. It's absolutely specific. So I'm not going to tell you how to get maps. You can look on page 20 of your handout, which will tell you how to get maps. But the point is that we have these restriction enzymes. Now, I have to talk a little bit about vectors. We have vectors because they allow the piece of DNA that you're interested in cloning, whether it's a messenger RNA or whether it's a part of the genome or whatever, to be replicated faithfully in a cell. And that cell could be a plant cell, it could be an animal cell, it could be a yeast cell. God, I love talking about this stuff. It's so much fun. It could be a bacteria cell, it could be anything. But you've got to have a vector. And the most important property, David, of the vector is what we talked about last week, and that's the origin of replication. Because without an origin of replication, that vector can't replicate. Because in essence, a vector, Jason, is like a miniature chromosome, so to speak. That's all it is. And it allows the piece of DNA that you're interested in amplifying to be cloned away from everything else. And so there's many different kinds of vectors. You've talked about plasmids, these things that are found in bacterial cells. But that's only one kind of a vector. There's all kinds of other vectors. In fact, people don't, well, that's not really true, but I mean, plasmids are used, but plasmids are used kind of as the end result of stuff. But in the beginning, we use other kinds of vectors. And when I say the beginning, I mean when you're trying to find genes, you use other kinds of vectors. You don't use plasmids, as you read in the first week of discussion. We don't use plasmids to clone genomes. And the reason why we don't use plasmids to clone genomes, generally, it's not absolutely true what I'm saying, but conceptually it's okay, it's because the fragments that are inside are too small. Okay? So if you want to clone a genome, you don't use a plasmid. You use a virus or an artificial chromosome. And so all of these vectors have been engineered. Of course, pieces of them occur in nature, but in fact, they've been engineered to do what we want them to do. And so what that says is that we could have plasmids, we can have viruses, we can have artificial chromosomes, but they all have certain characteristics. And Sam, you know what those characteristics are. Tell me about the characteristics of a vector. What do you have to use? What does that vector have to use it?
An origin of replication.
Absolutely. What else?
Restriction sites.
Has to have restriction sites. Specific ones, right?
Specific ones.
So we have origin of replication, we have restriction sites. What else? Something very important. A third thing. Critical. Absolutely so important. You put it down in all of your quizzes. Every one of them, you've talked about that. What is it? Betty!
Does it have to have a marker?
Markers mean anything. I don't know what that means by marker.
Something you can select for?
Something you can select for. So you have to have a way of selecting for your plasma that has the piece of DNA you have in it. All those things are characteristics of
what's an example of the thing to select for?
You tell me.
Is it the antibiotic resistance stuff?
You tell me.
Yeah?
You tell me.
Okay, yeah, it is.
Sure?
No.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
You're positive? I know you wrote it down on your quizzes.
Positive.
Okay, I'll accept that. So we have these different vectors. We have plasmids, we have viruses, we have all kinds of things. And I'm not going to go into it because you're going to have a lot of fun dealing with it in your take-home test. But these vectors have a lot of different selection characteristics. Here's a plasmid in which you can select for both antibiotic resistance and color. And I'm not going to tell you about that because you'll be playing with that on your take-home test till you're blue in the face. But the point here is that you have to have something that's selectable. And I know, Sam, that you know that because I know that you've done reasonably well on your quizzes. and all of your quizzes said select with antibiotics, so that had to be a selectable marker. But the point here is, the reason why I'm going over this is to reinforce some of these things. So we have these tools that you're vaguely familiar with, but hopefully specifically familiar with. But we have, and again, this is the basis of all of these applications. We have these libraries that you make. And what are these libraries? These libraries are the collection of all the genes in a genome. That's called a genome library. Or we have a cDNA library, which is the collection of all the messenger RNAs in a cell population. So we have these libraries because you can use these tools, you can use these enzymes, these vectors, and all of these other kinds of things to clone either the genome, as you know, or clone messenger RNAs. And there's different reasons to do different things, as I'll tell you about in a second. But we have these libraries. And keep in mind that cloning means isolating a specific fragment of DNA or a specific messenger RNA away from everything else. That's what's meant by cloning. So you're purifying these things. And so, therefore, you have a library. And if you have a library of human genome, you might have a million different clones. And you would store them in different vials. You'd have a million different vials. Or if you had a library of the E. coli genome, you might have a few thousand of them, and you'd store them in different vials. And every vial would represent a different piece of DNA in that genome. Or, Nick, if I had a library of the pancreas messenger RNA, I might have a vial with 20,000 different messenger RNA, cDNA clones. Messenger RNA 1, messenger RNA 2, messenger RNA 3, 4, 5, 6. The point here is that a genome library contains everything. So if you want the switches, if you want the regulatory sequences that turn on genes and turn off genes, if you want the sequences that splice things out of genes, if you want the beginning of a gene, if you want the end of a gene, you need the genome library. If you want to find out the key to regulating all of the genes in your chromosomes, and if you want to find out the key to going from a single-celled zygote to us, you need to study the genome, because that's where all the regulatory sequences are and the switches and the modules and all those things. However, if you're interested in a specific messenger RNA, let's say maybe to make a drug, you need to make a messenger RNA library, like insulin, like globin, maybe like factor VIII. This messenger RNA or cDNA library does not have any switches because it comes after the switch. It has the genetic code. It has the start of translation. It might have some signals for post-translational modification of the protein, but it ain't going to have anything that says turn the gene on, turn the gene off, stop, start, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Is that clear? Daisy? No? This is very important. So, Chris, if I was going to sequence the human genome, would I make cDNA library or genomic library? Absolutely. If I was interested in finding an insulin clone, would I sequence pancreas, messenger RNA, or look in the genome? Could do either, but what might be easier for insulin? Yeah, might be easier to do the mRNA. Lisa?
I was wondering, are you ever going to talk about how scientists actually go about sequencing genes?
We actually talked about that in discussion, and you had a quiz on how scientists go about sequencing.
No, like, how do they actually find out the sequences of?
Can you be more specific? It's kind of vague.
Like, how do they know if a protein gene, or if, I don't know, blood cell gene is a blood cell gene? Like, how do they know, like, the exact basis sequences?
Well, didn't you go over that in discussion, Gloria? Just a little bit. So we had a little bit of sequencing. So the answer to your question is, we can talk about that more in technical depth if you want to come in and talk to me in office hours. I'm happy to do that. But I think if you follow what I'm going to tell you about today, you'll see how people found that the hemophilia factor 8 gene was the factor 8 gene. And so what I'm going to try and tell you, if that's the answer, if that's what you're looking for, how you know a specific gene is a specific gene. Okay, well, that was the subject of how you found the insulin CDNA clone in this week 2 of discussion, because you went through a whole series of experiments in that discussion using antibodies and stuff in order to find the insulin cDNA. So there's a variety of ways in which you can do that, but I think you'll see, at least in one case, how you can find that for factor 8. Okay? It's a good question, but I thought we had covered some of it. Are there any other questions related to this? Daisy, you with me? Jordan, you with me? You got that smile on your face. Why is that? It is intriguing stuff. Okay, so we have genomic clones and we have cDNA clones. And in fact, what Lisa said is very important, because what Lisa really asked, I think, is how do you find a particular specific gene? How find a specific gene? I think that's what you asked, Lisa. How do you find the insulin gene? How do you know it's the insulin gene? How do you find the factor 8 gene? How do you know it's factor 8? How do you find the human growth hormone gene? How do you know it's human growth hormone? And I think that that's really a major question. In other words, how do you find a specific gene in a genome library? How do you find a specific messenger RNA in the mRNA library? And there's a number of ways to do that. For cDNAs, you learned one specific way to do that. And you'll learn more about it on your take-home test, and that is you make antibodies, and you use these things called expression vectors, and you get the bacteria that the cDNA clone is in to make the protein you're interested in, and you use an antibody to find that clone. We talked about that in discussion, and I think you had that on a quiz. So the point is that you also have that on your take-home test again. So that's one of the ways you can do that. You can't do that for a genome library, because those genes, if they have introns, aren't going to be expressed in bacterial cells. And I think we talked about that a few weeks ago. But the point is that you have a variety of different ways in which you can find the gene that you're interested in. So coming back to Lisa's question, again, you need to know something about something. So in the case of insulin, what was known was the sequence of the protein, and insulin had been isolated so you could make an antibody, and you can use the antibody to find the clone in the bacteria that synthesizes insulin by using an antibody antigen test. That's one way in which you could do that. You could also find the insulin cDNA in your library because you could sequence it if you knew the sequence of the protein. Okay, it's a second way in which you could do that. If you could do high-throughput sequencing like we can do now, and if you knew the sequence of those proteins, you could just sequence everything and then look for them in a database, and you'd find them by using the genetic code and doing this translation. So there's a number of ways to do that. If you had an insulin messenger RNA that you purified because it's tiny, which it is, you could use the insulin messenger RNA as a probe to go into a genome library and find the gene, a radioactive probe. So there's a number of ways in which one can do this, and I think you should review, all of you, that article on recombinant proteins by Gilbert, because it goes over all of these different procedures. But let me show you one way in which one can do that. So, here's the problem. And I think this is the problem you asked me about, Lisa, which is the problem I raised today. How do you find the factor 8 gene when you don't really know anything about it except the protein? How do you find the factor 8 gene when you don't know anything about it except the protein? Well, there's this marvelous thing, Lisa, called the genetic code. And if I know something about the sequence of the protein, I can use the genetic code to predict something about the sequence of the gene or the messenger RNA. Agreed? Clear. Therefore, even if I don't know anything about the gene, if I know something about the protein, I can find the gene. I can't find the messenger RNA because I don't know where the gene's active. Do you agree with that, Summer? You wouldn't know where to look. You wouldn't know where to look. The brain, the skin, the kidney, the liver, whatever, be too much work. But the gene's always going to be there, right? So if you don't know anything about anything, the first place to look for a gene is in the genome. So you have to look in the genome. And if you know something, like the sequence of the proteins, you can basically try and find the gene by playing a particular game that I'll tell you about in a second. So here's the strategy. I told you this was going to be a little bit technical, but it's technical and conceptual at the same time, because in reality, all I'm doing is reviewing things that you've had before. So the concept is that in order to find the factor VIII gene, you have to look in the genome, because it's in the genome, but you don't know where the gene is active. But it's someplace in the genome. And so in order to find this factor VIII gene, you need to make a genome library. You need to clone the gene. And then you need to find in this library which clone is the factor VIII gene. Now, after you find that gene, you can use that gene as a probe to find out where the gene is active. In other words, you can use that gene to find out whether it's active in the liver, active in the kidney, active in the pancreas, active in the brain, active anywhere. And I'll show you how you do that in a second. It's not called a southern blot, it's called a northern blot, doing the same process, only using RNA instead of DNA. And once you find that messenger RNA where it's formed, then you can make a cDNA library. And from that cDNA library, you can insert that in a vector and get that vector to make the protein. And once you have the protein, you have the drug. And that's, in fact, how factor VIII as a drug was made. And so let me tell you exactly how that happened. So let me start in the beginning. We want to make a library of the human genome. The reason I'm telling you about this is where everything begins. If you want to sequence the human genome, the first thing you got to do is make a library of it. You can't do anything unless you've got a specific fragment of human DNA or any genome, any organism's DNA, in a specific test tube. So in order to make a human genome library, you need a vector and you need cells and all of those different kinds of things, the tools of genetic engineering. But we're not going to use plasmids. And we're not going to use plasmids because the human genome is 5 billion base pairs in size. And because it's 5 billion base pairs in size, we don't want millions and millions of clones. Because, David, if I have to find a specific clone, is it easier to look for it among a library of small numbers of clones or large number of clones? If I'm looking for a specific gene, is it easier to find that gene in a small population of clones or a large population of clones? Exactly. Turn that on so I can hear you.
In a small population of clones.
In a small population of clones. See, what I'm really doing here is conceptualizing all the things that you've read about the entire quarter. A lot of things didn't make a lot of sense, but hopefully I'm making some sense of them right now. So if the genome is large, you want as small numbers of fragments as possible in this thing called your genome library. So you're not going to use a plasmid because the size of DNA that will be replicated in plasmids are very small. So in order to sequence the human genome or find one of these genes to cure a lethal human disease, let me say that again, to cure a lethal human disease, we're not playing on a playground here. We're saving people's lives. You start with a human genome library. But you don't start with a plasmid, you start with a virus. And so you convert a virus that kills bacteria into a vector to genetically engineer genomes. And in this case, we use a virus called Lambda. And it's a virus that infects E. coli. And it's a lethal virus in some cases. And there it is. It's a fascinating virus called Lambda. You'll know everything there is to know about this virus by the time you're through with your take-home test. You'll be, in fact, sick of it. You'll know everything there is to know about it. But the point is that this is something that infects your gut bacteria and kills it. That's how the bacteria virus survives. It takes over the bacteria and destroys it. But it's a very interesting virus. It's an interesting virus because this virus was the virus that was first used to make genome libraries. And the reason why it was used to make genome libraries is for a very important point, conceptually. It has a genome which is 45,000 base pairs in length. This genome contains everything in it necessary to infect a bacteria and kill it. It contains everything in it in order to replicate it and make its head and tail. That's the morphology of this virus. Has a head, has a tail. The DNA is in the head, the tail attaches to the bacteria. Show you an electron micrograph of that. The head is where the DNA is, the tail, and we have these little things. This binds to the surface of the bacteria. The DNA is injected like a syringe into the bacteria. It replicates and it kills cells. That's what viruses do. Any of you have herpes virus, you get these little pustules, whether it's a cold sore or a genital sore, the virus is killing your cells. The problem with the herpes virus is that the genome's incorporated into your genome, so you never can get rid of it for the rest of your life. That's not like this virus. This virus doesn't incorporate under most circumstances into the genome of E. coli. But the point here is that it has a genome. And the genome specifies the head proteins, and it specifies the tail proteins. And this genome is 45,000 base pairs in length. But what's interesting about this genome is everything that's necessary for the survival of this virus is on these things called arms. This part in the middle, the virus doesn't even need. That's pretty nifty, isn't it, Brian? So where would you clone your human DNA in this virus? In the middle, because you can get rid of this and the virus will still replicate. But it'll carry along your DNA instead of its own. So the point is that people who worked on this virus recognize this, that all the genes that are necessary for replication in this E. coli are on this end, and all the genes that are necessary to make these heads and tails, the proteins, are on the other end. But the stuff in the middle is not necessary for anything in reality. So the point is that you can make a vector out of this thing. And when you make a vector out of this, the virus naturally carries the DNA into the bacterial cell. So if you stick some of the human DNA in this vector and you use this to infect the bacterial cell is going to replicate the viral genome. The viral genome is carrying your DNA, so now it's being replicated along with the virus DNA. And what's the selectable marker here, Sam? It's not an antibiotic. It's not a color. It's destroying the bacteria. And why is that a selectable marker? Because when you plate these bacteriophage on a lawn, this is called a lawn, here's the bacteria, you infect these bacteria with these phage, here's the bacterial cells, the cells have been infected, and where they've been infected, they destroy the bacteria and they form a clear region on the plate called a plaque. One plaque is the result of one viral infection. That means one plaque, one clone. Each plaque is a clone of viruses. If the virus has a specific piece of human DNA, a specific piece of human DNA is found in a plaque. So what I'm saying is human piece DNA 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14. On this plate, I could have cloned 14 different regions of the human genome in this lambda virus because each virus has a separate restriction fragment, as you'll see in a second. Each of these viruses independently affects these cells, and each one then kills these cells and forms this plaque. And if you want to isolate the virus, you just find it in this middle region. So you have a selectable marker. A selectable marker is a clear region on a plate. And you can see it here on this diagram. How do you clone the human genome? You clone the human genome in between these arms. And how can you do that? I'll show you in a second, but there it is. You'd put the human DNA right in here. And generally, you can clone 20,000 base pairs of DNA. in this vector. Plasmid vector is 2, 3, 4,000. But now we can put 20,000 contiguous bases of DNA in the middle of this particular vector. And that's the beginning of cloning the human genome by using this virus, not a plasmid. Ben, is it clear?
The one question I had is...
I'm sure you have many.
Wouldn't you need another selection marker? Because even if the virus didn't take up your DNA, it would still kill the bacteria and make a plaque.
Ah, very good question. Wouldn't you need another selectable marker? Because even the virus that doesn't have your DNA would make a plaque. Well, the reason why that doesn't happen is because you use restriction sites with this virus genome to purify this arm and to purify that arm. You actually separate them from each other because they have different sizes. One arm is 20,000 base pairs in length, the other arm is 11, and the piece in the middle is of a different size. So if you digest this virus with a particular restriction enzyme, you'll get three fragments, and you can purify them. So when you start with purified arms, and the arms can't do anything by themselves. The reason why the arms can't do anything by themselves is because even though the stuff in the middle doesn't do anything, you have to have 45,000 base pairs to go in that head. So if you just have the arms by themselves, they can't fit in that head. I know it's counterintuitive. So you have an automatic marker, so to speak. Is that Daisy's hands up there or Jordan's? Daisy, go ahead. Good question.
So does that mean then that when you're working with all of the viruses that you're going to put onto the lawn, they're all just purified arms? There's no complete...
So it's purified arms that have been ligated with the human restriction digested DNA. I haven't got there yet.
And is there any possibility of there being a mistake in the purification in which there would be the whole, sequence?
It's rare. Okay. So you can't have that happen, but the frequency of that is so small that it doesn't really matter. So the answer is your library contaminated with some wild-type virus that have no human DNA in it? And the answer to that is yes, but it's one in a million, so it's not a factor. So we have this virus, which is a vector for genetic engineering. It's a vector for genetic engineering because it infects E. coli. It infects E. coli, and you can use it to package human DNA or plant DNA. When we made the first libraries of plant DNA, 25 years ago, we used this virus. So you can put your genes in the head of this virus, and your genes then will be injected into the bacteria, and the bacteria will replicate the viral DNA along with your DNA. Each plaque is a clone and therefore has a specific sequence of DNA. And here's how it works. You with me, Becca? Sure? So here's the viral genome. We isolated it. The viral genome, Matt has a specific restriction enzyme, MAT, correct? Has a map. Because of the map, I'll know where this part and that part of the genome is. Do you agree with that, Brian? It's the only way I'll know. T, do you agree with that? It's only because of this map. I have a specific restriction site there, a specific restriction site there. BAM1. I take these arms here and I purify them. Those arms there and I purify them. And they have sticky ends. And I get rid of the middle. That means that any time I would digest human DNA or anything else, Kyle, with BAM1H1, I could stick it in the middle of these two arms, correct? If I stick it in the middle of these two arms, I have a synthetic virus, correct? And that synthetic virus is now genetically engineered, and I can now allow that virus to replicate in the bacteria. So this is making a synthetic genome. Only in this case, I'm making a synthetic viral genome. And that's exactly what I do. I take these arms, I purify them, and I take my human DNA, I digest it with something equivalent to BAM. Don't worry about what the enzyme is up there. And I take these fragments and I insert them inside those two arms, and I ligate them together with, remember this enzyme called ligase, to seal those phosphodiester bonds. 20,000 base pair size fragments, not two, not three, not five, big ones. 20,000 base pair size fragments. Let's say there were 50,000 base pair size fragments. It's 5 times 10 to the 4th. The human genome is 5 times 10 to the 9th. All I'd need is 100,000 of these clones, and I'd clone the whole genome. If I use the virus, I'd need many millions. So the advantage of using this phage, Sam, is that I have a selectable marker. The selectable marker is killing the virus, killing the bacteria. The advantage of using this phage is I can incorporate big pieces. And the biggest advantage of this is I don't use transformation. I use a natural infection process of a virus. Do you think that's efficient? Absolutely. This is natural stuff. So we're now subverting a natural pathogen, a bacteria, virus that infects bacteria, to clone human genes or any other genes in a very nifty way. This is 25-year-old technology, but it's still used. It's still pretty nifty. Now, here's the most technically challenging thing I'm going to tell you the entire quarter. So I want you to pay attention. And seriously, this is the most technically challenging thing I'm going to tell you the entire quarter. And in fact, I have to tell you this because, Lisa, if I don't, you will not understand how we find human genes. Nor will you understand how you can clone the human genome. Nor will you understand how we can make maps of the SNPs of the human genome. Nor will you understand how we sequence the human genome. So I have to tell you how it was done. And I can't nursery school you on this one, quote unquote. I have to tell you exactly what it is, and it's not that difficult. But I want you to listen to me, and then we'll take a break. We have these things called restriction enzymes. Brian, if I use a lot of that enzyme, can I digest the human genome so that every single solitary site is cleaved with the enzyme? You agree with that?
Yes.
So if I take the human DNA and I mix it with a ton of restriction enzyme of a specific kind, every single solitary site in the human genome will be digested, correct?
Yes.
You agree with that?
Yes.
Every single one?
Yes.
But what if I only take a smidgen, a pinch of that enzyme, and mix it with human DNA? Is every site going to be digested or not? It's important to hear this.
Given enough time, I believe it will.
But let's say over a short period of time. Talk into the microphone. Just a smidgen.
Yes.
How many would say yes and how many would say no? Chris? I take a ton of enzyme, I throw it in with DNA, it digests all the sites. Right?
Yeah.
What if I only take a little tiny amount? Let it go for a small amount of time?
I mean,
it's like cooking a steak.
It sounds like no.
Well, if you cook the steak for a long time, what's going to happen?
It's going to get well done.
If you cook it for a minute, what's going to happen?
It's going to be rare.
So what about an enzyme that works as a catalyst?
It's not going to do that much cutting in a short period of time.
It's not going to do that much cutting. But now, what it cuts, would it be random?
No.
What do you think? For that site?
Yeah.
It'd be random. Okay, so, conceptually, I have a piece of DNA, and I have a site. There's the sites. These are four identical molecules of DNA, Chris. If I use a lot of the enzyme, tell me what sites are going to be digested in these molecules. A lot.
Yeah, all of them.
This one, that one, that one. You agree with that?
Mm-hmm.
On molecule one, right? That one, that one, that one on molecule two, right?
Mm-hmm.
That one, that one, that one on molecule three. That one, that one, that one on molecule four. What's the size of those fragments going to be? That size, right? What's the problem with that?
I wasn't aware there was one.
Well, what if this DNA fragment represents one gene?
You've got a bunch of genes floating around?
Bunch of genes or?
Bunch of pieces of genes?
Bunch of pieces of genes. How are you ever going to find your gene?
You're not.
Wouldn't they be in every different clone? Mm-hmm. You're going to have clones with different parts of your gene. How are you ever going to find them?
Not.
You're not. Would you want that situation?
No.
Well, would you?
I don't know.
To get an intact gene. Would you want that?
No. No.
Loda, do you follow that? So if you take a lot of this restriction enzyme and you take the human genome and you digest it to what's called completion, you're going to digest every single solitary site in the genome. And if the genes are big, you've now destroyed your genes. Furthermore, I'm just going to tell you this. If you use an enzyme that recognizes 6 base pairs, on average, the size of the restriction sites are 4,000 base pairs. Are they going to clone in this virus, Chris?
No.
Exactly. So why would you not want to do this complete digestion? One, you're destroying your genes. And two, they're not going to clone in this vector. And three, if you were making a library of the human genome with small fragments, you need many more clones. So no one would want to do this. And furthermore, if you were sequencing the human genome, would you want to know that this fragment is next to that fragment, which is next to that fragment, which is next to that fragment, next to that fragment? Could you do that if you did that to completion? In other words, if I had all these pieces, would you know how to get them together?
Nope.
All right. Is everyone with me? It's important. Now if I take a little bit, let's say I just cooked that steak, Chris, you know, for a minute or so. Remember, everything we do with nucleic acids, we're working with populations. You're never working with one molecule. You're working with millions of identical molecules. Okay? Remember way back to your chemistry, Avogadro's number, 6 times 10 to the 23rd? So if you're working with a mole of gene, you have 6 times 10 to the 23rd molecules. And in fact, if you do any molecular biology, Avogadro's number is critical, wouldn't you say, Mike? If you don't know that, you're really in bad shape. So the point here is that you're working with, if you work with a tenth of a mole, we now have, you know, X numbers of molecules. So you're always working with molecules. Now we're working with this small amount of enzyme, a smidgen. Now what's going to digest? Tell me, Chris.
Working with a small, and what is fraction of Avogadro's number do we have?
Just a tiny amount of enzyme. Is this site going to digest?
Maybe.
Well, let's say it does.
Okay.
Will that one?
Let's say it does.
You can. That one?
No.
That one?
Yes.
Could. This one?
Definitely not.
That one?
Certainly.
Okay. That's fine. Down here?
Yeah.
All of them? Maybe.
Just that one, not those other two.
Okay, what about down here?
No, not that one.
All right, what have I left with when I do that? Now, this is the stuff I'm going to put in my viral genome. So here, I've got this. So here I have this piece, and then I have this piece, and that piece, right? So I have this little fragment without any site here, and then I have from here, which is here to here. Okay, that digests there. And then I have another one from here all the way out to there. So I get 3 pieces there, right? Now I have from here, I have this piece all the way to here. And I have that site there. And then I have this fragment, which goes to here. And then I have something out there. And this one, I have this piece. But then I have all of these pieces there, and on that one I have everything. What have I now, in a crude way, created, Chris?
A library for that gene?
Well, what have I created with these fragments? This is 1, 2, 3, 4. Poorly drawn, I know.
Well, you've got the whole gene, and you've got a bunch of little fragments.
Are they overlapping?
Yeah.
So does this piece right here contain these 2 fragments?
Yes.
Does this piece here contain that fragment, and that fragment?
Yes.
What I've done is I've created a series of molecules of DNA that overlap. Do you see that?
Mm-hmm.
OK, Okay, let me show you from a better diagram, much better diagram than what I draw. If I did that with this region of the genome, notice what I've created. I've created a series of overlapping DNA fragments. Chris, can you see why that's so important? How many different genomic clones would I get from those fragments? One, two, three, four, five. Right?
Yeah.
What if I found this genomic clone out here? And let's say the gene is huge. This is only part of the gene. Could I go from this clone to find the rest of the gene over there? Theoretically.
Yes.
Because I would have a probe representing this part of the gene, and part of that probe overlaps with this clone over here. And therefore, this clone extends out. So in a sense, I could walk from this part of a gene to that part of a gene because some clones have more of the gene and other clones have less. Jordan, do you see that? When I make my library this way, each of these parts of this gene will be on a separate phage in the library. And if the gene is huge, which I'll show you that it is, you're not going to get any one gene on any one clone. And so the point here is that if you make these overlapping fragments, you have a way of going from one part of a gene to another part of a gene in your library. And if you were trying to do this to sequence the human genome, you'd want to go from one end of a chromosome to the other end of a chromosome because you'd want to have clones of every part of the chromosome because you have to sequence it. And you have to know this is one end and this is the other end. The only way you can do that is to get these overlapping DNA fragments. And that's why I'm telling you about this, because it's critical. And the only way you can find large genes is to do this thing called chromosome walking in order to go from one clone to the other. So what am I talking about? Let's say we have a large region of the human genome. And let's say in this large region of the human genome, we have a gene that we're really interested in, a gene that's hundreds of thousands of base pairs in length. There's no way you can clone this one gene, hundreds of thousands of base pairs in length, like the muscular dystrophy gene, which is a million base pairs in length, or the cystic fibrosis gene, which is a million base pairs in length, or the hemophilia gene, which is 75,000 base pairs in length. There's no way you can clone this one gene on one vector. It's too big. So the only way that you can clone it is in pieces. But if you clone it in pieces, you have to find a way to put the pieces together. If you digest these fragments to completion, there's no way to put them together. They don't have anything that connects them. If you digest them just a little bit and get these overlapping fragments, that means that in your library of human DNA, there's going to be a clone that's going to be related and next to, in the genome, another one. There's going to be another clone which is going to be related to and next to, in the genome, another one. And if you want to sequence the whole human genome, you have to go from this end of a chromosome, and you have to go to this end of a chromosome, and you have to line them up all precisely. It all starts with this. You have to connect the pieces. The only way you connect the pieces is by overlapping fragments. This is the most important concept in genetic engineering because this is how it all starts in reality. I didn't tell you about this 8 weeks ago because it's a little bit too technically sophisticated, but you can see conceptually how this works. So let's say we have a gene in this region of the genome. Here it's in the genome. Everything starts in the genome in chromosomes. I purify the DNA. I digest it just a little bit. And notice I get one fragment, two fragments, three fragments, four fragments. Chris, they all overlap, don't they? If I have a part of a gene here, it's not going to be on that fragment, not going to be on that fragment. This part of the gene down here won't be on that fragment. That means if it's a big gene, it's going to be found on one, two, three, four, or more clones. In order to get that whole gene, you need all those clones. Matthias, the only way you can get from one clone to the other is to have these overlapping regions. Why? Because in your library, this clone contains nucleotide sequences that are also present on that clone. Therefore, theoretically, you could use a probe for this region to find in your library that clone. You could use a probe from this clone to find in your library that clone. You could use a probe from that clone to find what's next to it. That's called walking. Walking from one clone to the next clone. And if you walk from one clone to the next 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 clone, you can walk down the entire chromosome. You can walk everywhere on a chromosome, which is critical for sequencing, in fact, the human genome. You can't do it any other way. Is that clear? Heather, you'll see why I'm telling you this in a second. It's really nifty stuff.
Okay, so just for clarification, the reason you're able to have overlapping ends...
it's because partial digestions.
Is partial digestion of amplified DNA, right?
No.
Not just
whole genomic DNA. You amplify it after you clone it in the bacteria virus.
I'm missing something. How can it be overlapping if you're just cutting it?
Because in any population of human DNA that you use, every region of the human DNA is represented millions of times. It's back to Avogadro's number. 6 × 10²³ molecules in a mole. If I have a mole of a factor 8 gene, I have 6 × 10²³ identical factor 8 genes.
So you're using like a lot of cells.
So we're using a lot of cell DNA to start with. It's a population. So you have a lot of each gene in your test tube to start with. I mean, do the calculation. A mole is a gram molecular weight. You know, if I have a microgram, which is 10⁻⁶, let's say 6 moles simplistically, I'm still going to have 10⁻⁹ molecules of that gene. So in a sense, I'm going to have a lot more of these overlapping fragments depending upon how much DNA I start out with. So you start out with a lot. And I think this is the concept that's very hard to grasp. When you do cloning, you're working on populations of molecules. A mole of a factor 8 gene is 6 × 10²³ genes. You know, 1/20th of a mole of a factor 8 gene is, you know, 1,000 genes. It's still a tremendous number. So you're never working with one gene or one DNA strand. You're always working with many. In your cells, there's two of each one. So even if we had one cell equivalent, Shauna, we took one cell from your body, each gene would be present twice because you're diploid. But we would take a lot more than that. Okay. Is that clear? Melissa? I hope it is. How do we find the factor 8 gene? Well, it's pretty simple. We know the factor 8 protein, and we know what its amino acid sequence is. Because we purified a tiny, 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 tiny amount. And we got its sequence. And we have a genetic code. And from that genetic code, I can predict what the sequence will be. Now, the sequence that you predict will not be unambiguous. Anton, it's not going to be unambiguous because the genetic code is degenerate. But I could predict every codon for each of these amino acids. So in this case, there's going to be 2 codons, 3 codons, 2 codons, 1 codon, 2 codons, 2 codons, 1 codon. Therefore, I could use a gene machine and synthesize each of those sequences. Is that clear? But how many different sequences am I going to have to synthesize? I don't know which of these sequences is the one in the factor 8 gene. All I can predict is that, in fact, one of them might be there. But I can't predict which one. So therefore, I've got to synthesize every possible combination. And how many combinations are there? Well, the number of combinations is simply the number of different possibilities. 2 codons, 3 codons, 2 codons, 2 codons, 2, 48 different probes I have to make. So I have to synthesize in exactly the same nucleotide sequence 48 different combinations. And that's easy. This was done 20 years ago. It's trivial. And then I make those 48 probes radioactive. One of them is going to be complementary to a part of the factor 8 gene. The part of the factor 8 gene that specifies this part of the protein. Would you agree with that, Sommer? It's not going to be the whole gene. It'll just be a little part of it. So then how do I do that? I go and I plate out my genome library. There it is. I plate it out on a bacterial plate. Remember I said each of these little plaques represents one clone. I have now my radioactive probe. It's kind of like a southern blot. I'm not going to go into what it is. You take your nitrocellulose filter. You put it over your plates of library. You take each clone, which is now a virus in a plaque, its DNA, and you put it on this piece of filter in exactly the same position. You use a radioactive probe, and you hybridize it to this filter, and it finds its complementary DNA, and using an autoradiography film, you can find, if you can see it, which you can't, but it's right there, that spot which represents that clone. So you then know that that clone contains your factor 8 gene. You go and purify it, and you sequence that clone, and you look to see that the sequence is complementary to the messenger RNA, to the protein sequence. Say that again more elegantly. You isolate that clone, just as you did on your tests in discussion. You sequence it. And the unambiguous test is there must be a region on that clone's DNA which is exactly the same as the sequence of one of those 48 synthetic probes that you used. And lo and behold, that's what was done. And interestingly or not, they found that here it is, right there, on that clone number 2. And what they found was that when they sequenced this clone number 2, it didn't contain the entire factor 8 gene. Contained some introns, mostly introns, contained some exons, because that's from an exon. The exon's right here because that's what you used to synthesize the probe. This is the region of the gene that gives rise to the protein that you sequence to make the probe. But now when you look at this clone, it's not the whole thing. So what they had to do was, and they didn't know what the size of the gene was, they had to start finding other parts of the gene. And they did this by that walking trick that I told you about. So they had this clone, so they could take part of this clone, making a restriction map. They know which end is which. They could take, let's say, this part, make a probe, go back into the library and screen it again, find the one that represents this region, sequence it, and they know that it was longer in that direction and contained more of the gene. And then they could take this clone, take a little probe, go back into the library and rescreen it over again, find this one, and extend it more. How do they link these up? They link them up by restriction mapping, because there should be sites that are shared by these overlapping clones, and they link it up by sequencing, and they link it up by looking at what the sequence codes. Lisa, I just showed you how you find a specific gene that codes for a specific protein in a genome library, by using the sequence of the protein and by making a synthetic probe and the genetic code, you can go into a genome library and find the gene. What was the surprise? The surprise was that the factor 8 gene was 70,000 base pairs in length. What was the surprise? That it wasn't on one clone, that it was on many. What was the surprise? That it had a lot of introns. In fact, you can see them. These are the exons, and the rest is intron, which is what I told you about on Tuesday. The genes are huge, and the part of the gene that codes for the protein is very small. Most of it is intron regions, which is amazing. And that was really a surprise at that particular time. And so again, I'm not going to go into this because I just did. We do this by walking from one region to another. You're going to have your fill of this for the take-home test, so I'm not going to go into it in any great length. But what I was saying before is if you start at one end of a chromosome and you do these partial digestions, You can get overlapping clones that overlap the entire chromosome. And because you have them, and they're specific clones, and you sequence them, Sam, then you know the sequence of the chromosome. Okay, let me finish this up. Only a couple more things to tell you. Lord, I now have the factor VIII gene. What can I do with it? If you had a factor VIII gene, what would you want to do with it relative to the hemophilia disease? We've now spent 5 years, and probably in this era, 40 people in order to do this. I could get you to do this in my lab in about a week. This took about 40 people 2 years to get this gene using this strategy. In fact, you could probably get this gene in an hour using the polymerase chain reaction. You now have these genes, but it's on different pieces, of course. What do you want to do with it?
You'd want to produce more, so you could use it.
Well, what's the first thing you might want to do with it relative to the disease?
Figure out how it...
connect some pieces here that we've been talking about in the class. Not just today, but the whole few weeks. What would you want to do with this gene? You now have the hemoglobin allele, the wild-type allele. What would you want to do with this before anything? What does that give you an entry into?
What was...
You now have a factor VIII gene, which causes a lethal disease in man, humans. What would you want to do with this immediately?
Oh, figure out how to stop it from...
Could never stop it. This can't stop the gene from being defective. Daisy?
Make a drug that can...
Even before that. Najla.
Develop a test for it?
Yeah, exactly. Now you have the ability to find a test for who are carriers of this lethal disease gene. Because now you can find markers. Because now you can have probes that you can use DNA blots in order to find a marker. And so remember I said the hemophilia is a big gene. There's a lot of different mutations. This is not something generally that's due to founder mutation, but in fact, you can find an RFLP. And for example, here's a mutation in one family that eliminated a restriction site, and here's a marker for a mutant hemophilia gene. So once you get the gene, you can now start and look for markers to say, you're a carrier, you're a carrier, you're a carrier, watch out when you have children. Or maybe you have hemophilia if you have some blood disorder, although that would be known in a different way. That'd be the first thing you'd want to do. The second thing that you want to do, and Lotta was correct, is make a drug. So let me finish this up, because I know it's been a mouthful for you. In order to make the drug, so you can do gene testing, because you have to have a marker, but in order to make the drug, you ain't going to use the gene. Why is that, David? We talked about that weeks ago. Why aren't we going to use the gene? David.
Can you repeat the question one more time?
How come we don't want to use the gene to make the drug? Goes all the way back to discussion week 2. See, it all comes back to haunt you, so to speak. How come we don't want to use the gene?
I'm not
sure. Make the drug. Yeah, you are. I know you are. This is why we're having this lecture today. I wasn't going to give this lecture, but Gloria and Mike urged me to give it. I was going to skip it and talk about patents, but they wanted me to give this lecture. Isn't that correct, Gloria?
Yes.
So how come you don't use the gene to make the drug? Betty!
Because in the population, there's different alleles of the same
gene.
No,
to make the drug, nothing. Lota. Go ahead. We're almost done, not quite.
Because it wouldn't produce a lot, and it'd be expensive?
Well, no, not really. Sommer.
Because you don't want the introns? You just want
well, that's exons. One reason, but how many different clones is the gene on?
Several.
It's a big gene.
Yeah.
You don't have it on any one clone. How are you going to use it to make a drug? You can't. You can't use this gene. One, if you're going to use it in bacteria, you can't because it has introns. That was one of the reasons, answers I was looking for, T, from your discussion number two. But more in more realistic terms, it's too big to work with, you know, 75,000 base pairs, and it ain't on one clone. So what's the simplest thing to use, Jordan? To make the drug.
An animal?
Okay. No, what's simple? An animal. But what are you going to use in the animal to make the drug?
Bacteria.
You're going to use a bacteria in an animal to make a drug? That didn't make any sense. Sommer? Yeah, we're going to use the mRNA. It's just these exons here. It's small. It's tiny. Very tiny. It's easier to work with, and it only has the genetic code, and theoretically you could put it in a bacteria. In this case, you don't make it in a bacteria because you have to have these modifications, these cascades and stuff. So you do, Jordan, you're correct, make it in an animal. How are you going to find the mRNA when you don't know where the gene is expressed? Well, now we have a probe. It's the gene. Will that probe be complementary, Sommer, to a messenger RNA someplace? Someplace. Some parts of these exons will be complementary to some messenger RNA. So, we can do this thing called a northern blot. A northern blot. So we can, that's okay, I don't mind, that wakes me up. So we can find different tissues. We can isolate the RNA from these tissues, no restriction enzymes. We can separate these RNAs using electrophoresis on the basis of size. We can put them on a nitrocellulose filter. Those RNAs will be a schmear because they're all different sizes because they code for all different size proteins. We can hybridize that to our factor VIII probe, and one of those RNAs should, in fact, in this case it's not factor VIII, hybridize to only where the gene is active. And in the case of factor VIII, it's the liver. Ain't the blood, it's the liver. Now, if I know that it's in the liver, I can clone that messenger RNA. I can make a cDNA library. So I can make a cDNA library, which I do, using the techniques that you know about that I'm not going to go into again. In this case, using a plasmid vector or something else. And I make that cDNA library, I isolate the cDNA clone. Now it has no introns. Now it has just the coding sequence. And then I can take that cDNA clone, I can put it in a vector, can't I? And in that case, I put it in a genetically engineered vector that infects mammalian cells. Because this protein is one that's in a cascade of proteins, as I said in the beginning, that changes in size, just like the protein C you had in discussion. So I take it and I put it in a vector. I have a signal that says to transcribe this cDNA in a mammalian cell. I have an origin of replication from a virus that infects these mammalian cells. I put that in a mammalian tissue culture in vats of cells. And now this particular factor VIII messenger RNA is transcribed. The cDNA is transcribed. The protein is translated. Now we get factor VIII protein, and here is what happens when you treat somebody with hemophilia with factor VIII protein. You get a clot and they live. And now instead of dying at 2 or 3 or 20, they live for the rest of their lives forever, a happy, healthy, normal life. To me, that's a miracle. It's an absolute miracle. You're now curing. It's not a cure in a sense because they still have the defective gene, but you're treating a lethal disease in humans and allowing someone to have a normal life. And that's the goal of all of this, eventually, to do this with all of these inborn errors of metabolism. I appreciate that you sat through this little technically challenging lecture. I had to give it to you because it was important for me to conceptualize some of the things that you've read about in discussion and put them together. I had to give it to you in as simplistic form as I possibly could conceptually because you need it for your take-home test. But I primarily gave it to you not because Mike and Gloria urged me to give it to you. I gave it to you and saved it for, you know, the seventh week of class or whatever it is, the end of the sixth week, because this is genetic engineering. You read about it in discussion, but a lot of it didn't make a lot of sense. You've read about it in your textbook. Perhaps a lot of it didn't make any sense. I gave you this lecture to connect everything, but I also gave it to you to let you realize the power of this technology. And I gave it to you in order so to end this little lecture by saying, we don't have to do this anymore. We don't have to do it anymore because the human genome's been sequenced. Anytime you'd want a factor VIII gene, you can use the polymerase chain reaction to get it in 5 minutes. Anytime you'd want a factor VIII cDNA, you don't have to do it because it's done. And anybody that would need this to be able to treat this disease can buy it upon prescription from their physician. So the point is that this is what we did, and this is how much effort went into isolating and using these genes in the past, but now everything is much simpler and much more conceptual. So what are the conceptual points in summarizing? The conceptual points is that Lisa asked a very good question. How do you know what gene you have when you have it? And that's what this lecture was all about. How do you go from a pedigree to a gene to a drug when you don't know very much, but you have to know something? In this particular case, we knew a little bit about the protein, and that's why I took you through that. The conceptual points were that. How do you go from a protein to a gene? The conceptual points were the tools of genetic engineering, which are a little bit more than what you learned. The conceptual points were making a genome library, but making a genome library the real way, where you have to have these overlapping fragments because genes are big and you don't want to bombard a gene by digesting it to completion with these restriction enzymes. The conceptual point was that you can use vectors other than plasmids as tools of genetic engineering. The conceptual point was that some human genes, in fact, most are huge. Therefore, they can't be on any one clone. The conceptual point is that you have to use this thing called walking from one clone to another in order to get them all strung together. The conceptual point was the only way that you know that they're strung together is by their restriction map, because the overlapping clones will share sites or share sequences. The conceptual point is that human genes are huge. The conceptual point is that drugs are generally made from messenger RNA molecules and not genes because of introns in bacteria or because they're too big and they're not on any one clone. And the conceptual point is that genetic engineering has, will, and continue to will be a tool to help people live normal and healthy lives. Are there any handouts today? When you go out, there'll be handouts for your articles for discussion. You need to look some of this stuff over. It'll come into sense and focus when you work on your take-home. Have a good weekend, and I'll see you on Tuesday.